Welcome back to Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. In today's episode, I'm so excited about, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Rachel Bronson of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, one of my favorite organizations. They are the keeper of the Doomsday Clock, which is probably a reference most of you will be more familiar with. The Bulletin tracks existential risks from climate change to nuclear threats and disruptive tech. And each year they set this clock, the Doomsday Clock, as a way to inform the public and I guess a way to start conversation and also inform scientists and people who are actually working on these problems. Rachel has a bachelor's in history from the University of Pennsylvania and a master's and PhD in political science from Columbia University. She's just a wealth of information on this subject, and we're so honored she's on here today. So without further ado, here's the conversation Andrew and I had with Dr. Rachel Bronson. So Rachel, you've been president, CEO of the Bulletin since 2015, and I want to hear about your experience stepping into this role. But first, I want to give a brief overview of the Bulletin for those listening. It was founded in 1945 by Eugene Rabinowitch, just after the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In 1947, the Doomsday Clock was introduced as a sort of intuitive symbol of urgency, and it's arguably mostly responsible for establishing the Bulletin as a recognizable brand. And the clock indicates kind of existential risks. So what's your experience been like stepping into this role at a time when these risks are at an all-time high?
Well, the fact that the risks are at an all-time high is really what drew me to this role. I've worked in issues of U.S. national security and global peace and security for my career, and my background was on Middle East politics. But at the moment that I was making a transition, this position of president of the Bulletin opened up, and it was one that I thought was extremely important, and that the world really needed a stronger and active Bulletin given the issues that we face today. So, for example, I began in February of 2015, and in March of 2015, The Economist hit my doorstep, and on the front cover of that was a cover story entitled The New Nuclear Order. And issues of science and technology are moving so quickly, and all of us need to kind of think about the positives and negatives and how to reduce the risk. So the issues of the Bulletin were exactly what drew me to serving in this role, because I think we will all do better if the Bulletin is strong and engaged and accessible. So it was a pretty, it's a pretty important time, and that's what drew me there.
I wonder, you know, with there still being so much skepticism, especially in America, around things like climate change, what has been the reaction that you've noticed to trying to spread awareness of issues like climate change? I mean, I think everybody acknowledges that nuclear risks are a huge danger, but what about some of the more nuanced topics that people are still skeptical about?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. You know, at the Bulletin, we really sit at the crosshairs of two really important changes. One is a growing disregard for expertise, and the other is the kind of dislocation and change around media and how we all consume news. So there are some real serious headwinds facing the Bulletin. But what we experience at this moment is that although, you know, there's kind of controversy on the importance of expertise, and we see that in the climate change debate, among other things, there's a huge audience out there that is hungry for fact-based analysis and the kind of smart debate and discussion around foreign policy. And even though we hear of the blowback, our job is to really cultivate and engage those who are looking for us, to provide a safe harbor, if you will, for people who want to understand these issues better. And that's what we really see as our role. So our job isn't necessarily to convert skeptics or those who are just opposed to even thinking about that that climate change might be man-made. But our job, as I see it, is to get in front of audiences, particularly new audiences, who know that there is a role that humans are playing in terms of climate change, or who suspect that things are getting more dangerous when it comes to nuclear weapons and want to go somewhere to learn about it. We want to be in front of them. We want them to come to us because we think we're a place where you can rely on what you're reading and still see different opinions, but opinions that are fact-based and well thought through and are the essence of the different policy options that lie before us.
Don't you think that with there being so many skeptics of climate change, that it could be maybe potentially really important to try to communicate to those people why this is imperative that they get on the wagon and join the club, so to speak?
Yeah, you know, I'd love it if that could be true. And I feel like by us really speaking to those who are looking for good information, that gives them the tools to engage their family members and neighbors, because this is very complicated stuff, right? And right now we end up with this kind of divide between like, yes, no. But even those who kind of buy into the fact that this is man-made and there's documented evidence and most scientists will agree on it, it's still hard to find the language then when somebody comes at you with some kind of crazy theory about why it's not the case. And so we'd like to help them, give them the tools they need when they're sitting down at Thanksgiving with their families or whatever to have the conversations if they're able to. That's how we'll win the debate. But also, I think that, you know, right now, those who believe, who have been following this debate for years and know that, for example, climate change is man-made and has a very strong component of that, they're feeling very unmoored and they're feeling on the defensive. And our job is to kind of build the community that says there's actually a majority of people who believe this, and a super majority if you look internationally, and it just doesn't feel that way. And so our job is day in, day out, like, you're not alone. We've been arguing this for decades. Here's how to talk about it. Here's some of the interesting debates that are happening. And that's what I see as our mission. I don't want to lose those people in an effort to try to go out and bring the extremes in. I want to make sure that the middle and the majority in the middle who understand that climate change is man-made has the tools to be able to talk about it. And we, among others as well, of course.
Yeah, so for the doomsday clock, I didn't actually even realize it was tracking other threats other than just nuclear. I think it was originally devised just straight up as a nuclear threat indicator. Is that correct?
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's a really interesting question. So the doomsday clock was designed by an artist who was Marta Langsdorff, who was the wife of a Manhattan Project scientist and part of the formation of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And they had asked her to design a symbol that would appear on the front cover of our magazine. She created the clock. And she set it at 7 minutes to midnight to provide both a warning and a beacon for hope. And the warning was that humanity was really threatened and the dangers from science and technology were real. And she set it at 7 minutes to midnight to really convey that kind of urgency. What I love about the clock is that she did that because there's an opportunity to move the clock back, right? That's what the warning is all about, that if we don't do anything, the clock will tick to midnight, being kind of the apocalypse. And so there's also built into this clock this notion that we can turn it back or set it back or reset it, which is has over time become what's so powerful about the symbol. And so in 1947, when she designed it, the technological advancement that could destroy humanity was nuclear weapons. And so that's what we talked about. And nuclear energy is this poster child for dual-use technologies at a global scale. Over time, though, throughout our magazine, the writers for us, these scientists interested in and policymakers interested in the biggest issues of the day, did consider things like population growth, and they got into climate very early. But we didn't move the clock for reasons of climate until 2009. So you're very correct to see it as primarily a barometer of nuclear threat. Now, adding climate change to the clock was probably one of the most controversial decisions that my organization made. And the reason we did it, and it was after about, you know, a decade of debate, is to try to understand, what is this clock about? Is it about nuclear annihilation, or is it about the ability for science and technology to end life on Earth as we know it? We never had to distinguish between those two in the first part of our history, because the only technology, if you will, that could do that was nuclear technologies, right? But as we're kind of going through, and so the bulletin adds, runs a cover story in 1978 that says man is responsible for the changing environment, and we're starting to think about man-made biothreats and the effects of artificial intelligence. And you go back to our founders, who are thinking a lot about the quickening pace of science and technology and the need for all of us to build in ethics and politics into our thinking about this. Then it really is a barometer of something bigger. And so when my science and security board sits down to set the clock, they're answering two questions. Is humanity safer or at greater risk today than it was last year when we set the clock? And is humanity safer or greater risk today than it was over the nearly 75 years we've been setting this clock? And if you want to answer that question, which is what the questions I think the clock really is about, you have to include things like climate change. You have to start thinking about cyber and artificial intelligence and all of that. And so that's the question they're answering. And so we couldn't answer that by just focusing on nuclear issues, although each of those issues have a very different time horizon and very different dynamics associated with, which makes it very complicated to put it all into one clock.
Sounds like you guys might be due to change your name to Bulletin of the Atomic Disruptive Tech Climate Change Scientists very soon.
Yeah. Well, when you come up with something that's catchier than that, please tell us, because we'd be happy to consider it.
Yeah. I do wonder, is there like a hierarchy of priorities in your mind of all these risk factors? Is it, you said, you kind of alluded to the fact that it's not so much nuclear anymore on its own. Do you guys, in your research, is there a list of priorities?
Well, no, not in that sense. What we do think about, so if you come to our website, right, and our magazine, we track all three of these issues, nuclear risk, climate change, and disruptive technology, in our magazine, on our website, in our presentations. We're tracking all three of them. Because we've been doing nuclear since 1945, that's something where we have very deep ties, very strong board representation. Our history is really tied up with that. You start seeing climate enter into our writings. And like I said, in 1978, we run this cover story. And so climate is a very big piece of it now. But it's one that is newer for the clock, even though it's about 10 years old now. So it requires a little bit more explanation and how we think about it. So we just kind of present it a little bit differently. The disruptive tech, those are much newer issues for us, and we're much less well known in that space. So for us, when we're setting the clock and we're thinking about disruptive technologies, it tends to be more of a what's coming. How would we think about when we would move the clock for reasons of disruptive technology? How do they intersect with the other issues? Is it that intersection that we are most concerned about, or the technologies in and of itself? So we're really just asking, and we're doing different things with each piece of it based on both our history, but also where we are kind of in this moment. And probably what's most interesting, and this gets to your question on the hierarchy, is when we go into these clock setting discussions, you know, and we think about what's been happening globally. Sometimes it's obvious, like this year, it's just a nuclear story. This year, that's what the board really wants to focus on, because there's been, you know, terrific changes, or there's been the lack of change or scary changes, and they really want to make sure we focus on that. But sometimes it's on the climate side. So we moved the clock in 2015, from 5 to 3 minutes. And climate was a very, very big piece of that because the board was at the time very concerned about the lack of multilateral engagement on climate in particular at that moment when it was so required. And so it's not so much as a hierarchy in our presentation, but it's kind of when we come in to think about, well, what was the year that we just saw and how do we balance the pros and cons and then put it all together in kind of one message to the audiences that are going to want to read the clock statement and figure out why we set the time where we did. So that's kind of how we think about it. And, you know, sometimes it's quite interesting to see the nuclear people saying, I think it's a climate story this year, or the climate story saying, I think it's a nuclear or whatever, you know, and that's yeah. part of what's really interesting about the clock discussions.
We're going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. I promise.
It sounds pretty qualitative, like you kind of go in a room and discuss what the issues are and then sort of decide together what the settings are. Do people like vote on it or something like that? Or like how is the metric actually determined? And then also, is there like do you have enough sort of play within the clock that if you want to communicate the message that things are getting worse, you can, you know, set it closer. And if things are getting better, you might back off a little bit. I mean, it seems like climate change is just such a different threat that it's long term, basically. Like, I mean, the chance of something going wrong in the next year or two is remote. But then you have this long term threat that if people don't take some kind of action in 10 years, mm-hmm. 20 years, 30 years, it's going to be a serious problem for humanity, right? I mean, it is now to some extent, but it's really when we talk about doomsday, it's kind of further along. So can you really choose to set it at very close to midnight if doomsday is not imminent within the next year or two, but, you know, the threats are still ongoing that will cause it down the road, right? Whereas nuclear could be like the next day, nuclear catastrophe, right? So the timeline is so different that how do you balance that and how do you determine how to set the clock?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think there's at least two questions in there. The first is the qualitative part. So you can go onto our site and see our Science and Security Board. They're the ones who set the clock. The governing board is in there as well, but it's the Science and Security Board that sets it. We have a board of sponsors who join on occasion on the discussions, or elements of those board sponsors who do, and they kind of vouch for the setting of the clock. And so the people in that room are looking at the kind of hard data that you're looking for, the quantitative measures of risk throughout the year in their day-to-day lives. So that's what they're doing. When they come into the room, you are absolutely correct that it becomes their judgment about, are we safer or at greater risk this year compared to last year, this year compared to the last nearly 75 years. So that time then becomes a judgment or a qualitative discussion, a qualitative measure based on all of their quantitative work. So what's not happening is they all come in with their data, put it into some big computer that churns and churns and churns and spits
out. McNamara.
But it's they're doing that basically all year, you know, and then we kind of bring that into this room and say, okay, you take all that and what does it mean? And so a criticism that we get sometimes is that, well, this is a very blunt measure for very nuanced information, which is 100% true. But the response to that is often we ask experts and scientists, just tell me, are we safer or at greater risk? I don't want all the this and the that and the, are we safer or greater risk? And we force them to answer that very simple question very simply, because people can understand that. Then the next step is, well, if you want to understand, like, how did they get there? We always release our clock statement, which again is a summary or roll up of these discussions for how we got there. And then if you want to know even more, then there's ways through our website to kind of find the particular part of it that you're most interested in. but it is an absolute roll-up or a judgment of these experts. And what I think is really important about the clock, because of its elegance in conveying very, very complicated information, it allows all of us into this conversation, right? So to the extent to which this is our judgment, but to the extent to which people sit around their dinner table or are going up the elevator and say, I think it should be closer to midnight, or I think it should be further away than midnight, that's a conversation that we think is so important that doesn't happen any other way, because we don't even know how to start that conversation. Or for people's individual lives, if they said, you know, I think they should have included X. Well, why should we include that? You know, and often it'll be issues that are really prevalent to their communities, but maybe not global. And so there's a whole host of issues like that. And so for them, their clock and their community may look different. But if you're thinking about the future of humanity, these are the issues that we think are most important. So that's kind of answers the first part of the question. The second part of your question, which is climate change, has a very different time horizon than nuclear, you know, issues, which could really end life on Earth as we know it in the next 30 minutes. You're absolutely right. So the question is, what does midnight mean in climate? And we do talk about that quite frequently. To some extent, the climate scientists, one of the messages that they're trying to convey is, there's only a certain amount of carbon that can go into the atmosphere. And so at some point where you reach the maximum, and we're closely coming into that, and the effects of it will be felt in 100 years, but the decisions are happening right now that we need to make to keep us safe. So for the climate scientists, they will often think about, what is midnight in the client scenario? What does it mean now? And yes, like, how difficult is this in the state of the clock, which is, we know it's going to be, they know it's going to be getting increasingly worse. So how do you manage that with the clock? And then that becomes a conversation that they're having, because, you know, does this clock really represent what they're trying to say? And to some extent, yes, it's very important and urgent and dangerous right now. But they do struggle with the fact that these effects, even though they're being felt more quickly now than maybe some anticipated, this is going to be with us and getting worse for a number of years. And so it's something that they think about, of how to convey that, because this is all about conveying the urgency. They're comfortable with what they're saying now, but they are thinking in 10 years, how are they going to be able to talk about it with this clock as a metaphor?
Yeah. And to your point, Rachel, that it's that the clock is kind of an elegant way of simplifying these really complicated topics that the casual person isn't capable of, like, getting their head around entirely. I mean, that's why scientists are paid very highly for this work. You know, you also, what the clock does is it conveys a sense of urgency that people can and should do something to set the clock back, that, like you said, it's within our power. And so, you know, it's interesting to hear that you guys got, you've gotten some flack in the past for the simplicity of the clock, because in my mind, like, thinking about it from a marketing perspective or an advertising perspective, it's perfect. It's like, it's the perfect communication starter. And it does convey that there's things within our power we can do to reverse these effects. And so I think it's awesome, the conversation you guys are having. And I think the clock does a great job of that. So I think it is interesting to hear you talk about kind of the disparity between like the factors that Andrew brought up, like climate change versus nuclear risk and things like that, and how all that goes into the clock. I wonder what the next, do you guys have a gauge on what the next 10 years looks like for the bulletin? And do you guys have a sense on what kind of risks are coming down the road? Or are you guys just kind of gauging this on, like, a year by year basis, flying by the seat of your pants kind of thing?
Yeah, we do look at it like, what are the big issues coming up? And we do that in the context really of our magazine and website, right? So we will have editorial board meetings where we say, you know, here are debates on the climate side that really aren't being had in the way we think is important. So our scientists are really concerned about geoengineering, like what's been called hacking the environment, doing things to affect the environment to try to continue to pump carbon and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, but maybe not feel the effects of it. And they're very worried about that. And so those are issues of geoengineering we know are going to become much more popular, in part because of the situation we find ourselves in. But we're really concerned about that. So what are alternatives? So, you know, the editorial board, we've done special issues of our magazine on it. So we're like anticipating that these are issues that in 5 years we're going to be talking about in our clock discussions, but we're trying to get that at least into our body of material to draw on so that we're kind of ahead of the clock, if you will, on things like that. In this recent editorial board meeting, we were kind of talking about genetic engineering, CRISPR in particular, and how the science and the technology of genetic engineering is really overtaking that technology. Like, that's even old right now at this point. And here are other things that are coming, but we don't even have the laws in place globally or nationally to regulate it to the extent that we would like to. And I'm talking about, well, who does regulate it? Well, it seems, if I recall the discussion, the British were, you know, ahead on that. And how do we avoid the Chinese doctors creating twins, baby girl twins, before the global medical community is prepared for it? So, and so we haven't even created a very good baseline for understanding CRISPR, and the technology is already ahead of that. And so what are those technologies that we should be covering? So we do come in on the clock kind of this year compared to last, compared to history, but in our journal, in our magazine and our website, we're trying to get ahead of where we think things are going so that in 5-10 years, when we're in these discussions, we have a body of work to draw on.
What are the dangers of geohacking in the bulletin's mind? I'm curious to hear about that, because it seems like a lot of people would think that's just like a natural solution to some of these problems.
Well, so there's a number, and I'd strongly recommend that anyone interested in this come look at the last issue of the magazine.
Right.
It's on our site, and it's there. But it's things like if you deflect some are considering ways to deflect the sun's heat, right, and kind of create a shield to keep it from heating. You're still pumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. So the moment that shield that you've created falters, and the radiation's allowed in, the effects of that are significantly worse. So basically, in some of these geoengineering ideas, you've got to make sure that they're in place for time immemorial, that they never falter, they're always working, and they're becoming stronger as we continue to pump these gases into the atmosphere. So that while in a moment it seems like, well, that might help us for the next few years or whatever, then you're putting something in that has to work forever. And so concern about the logic of those kinds of solutions. You know, now if you're thinking about, well, you do that until you can find the solution, well, you better be investing really heavily then in that solution, because the problem is just getting worse and worse. And if that shield isn't there permanently, the effects of it will be even greater than we could imagine. So that's just one example, but we give like a host of them in the most recent magazine issue.
So entropy, in short. Andrew, I don't want to dominate the conversation here, and I know we've got limited time with Rachel today. Do you have anything else you want to say? I've got a couple more things I could ask, but
yeah, I mean, what are the main nuclear threats these days? Because it's all disjointed with the end of the Cold War. Basically, it seems like nuclear terrorism might be one of them, or rogue states like North Korea. That might be a big one. But how does that factor in the superpower nuclear threat, or I mean, even just like the former superpower, like Russian nuclear threat versus the U.S. compared with terrorists getting a nuclear bomb. I mean, does that even figure in? Because, like, with nuclear terrorism, obviously the damage they could do is pretty severe, but it would be sort of not on a global scale, right? So maybe that doesn't even factor in, right? Or I don't even know if North Korea, because that would be a devastating war. Maybe if there was a counterstrike, it could possibly result in a nuclear winter or something like that. But, you know, India, Pakistan, for sure. But it's unclear that sort of a smaller nuclear threat that we sort of see maybe today, or localized, let's say, would actually be a global threat, right? So
I think all of those issues are really important that you raise. We always start with the fact that the United States and Russia still control more than 90% of the nuclear weapons and material on the planet. So first and foremost, we're always looking at the U.S.-Russian relationship. And because it's so poor right now, that is a driving force of on the nuclear side of it being of the time being so close to midnight. So we're at 2 minutes to midnight now. We've been as far away as 17 minutes from midnight. We've gone back and forth, but we're very, very close. A big part of that is U.S.-Russian relations because of the deteriorated state of those of that relationship. And the consequence of that is the deteriorating architecture of arms control that has kept us safe. So very much in the news is the treaties that the US and the Russians are pulling out of, not only haven't signed, but are pulling out of, and the non-proliferation treaty that's coming up on its 50th anniversary, which is the cornerstone of arms control, is also seriously under threat. So the whole architecture of the arms control of the 1970s to the end of the, I would say up until about 2010, that has really helped keep us safe, is really deteriorated, if not collapsed. And so the U.S.-Russian relationship, the lack of a arms control architecture, the reinvestment by all nuclear states, U.S., Russia, now China, and Pakistan, India, others, into their nuclear arsenals is very worrisome to us. So the major powers of the U.S. and the Russian investing heavily, China continuing to invest, but now, as you mentioned, all these other actors who are investing in a way that suggests that nuclear weapons are usable. One of the debates that we're tracking that we're very concerned about is this move to back to quote unquote low yield nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons. And the concern, and there's two current concerns with that, is that our deterrence is based on the fact that that we will know if the other state is planning to use nuclear weapons. As we get into these smaller, more tactical nuclear weapons, it becomes also a lot more confusing if you put a nuclear warhead onto a conventional delivery system, that what's considered, how do you know if the other is moving to a launch? Because, boy, you don't want to get that one wrong. So we're concerned about all that. We're concerned about the investments. It all seems to be moving in the wrong direction. The logic that's kept us safe is being undermined. So that's kind of a very quick, big picture take. Now, in terms of terrorism, we remain concerned about that. We do think about how it might be used, how we're protecting materials, and so we do focus on it. But right now, what's happening at the state level is so disconcerting that a lot of our attention is being put on that. And we do look at the smaller states, because if India and Pakistan have an exchange, there is the real potential of a nuclear winter spreading globally. If the U.S. and the Russians you end up using tactical nuclear weapons, there's nothing in our strategy to kind of give us any confidence that we won't go straight up the escalation ladder into a strategic response. And I think if you speak to our experts, our greatest concern right now isn't a kind of planned strategic decision to use nuclear weapons, but rather the fog of war, with so much of this just confused and confusing, leads to miscalculations and misunderstandings that send us right up the nuclear escalation ladder. And we're really concerned about accidents and misperceptions at this moment in particular.
Per your earlier question, the name Bulletin of Existential Scientists comes to mind.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, this is then just becomes our issue, which is we come out of the Manhattan Project. We come out of a time where it's the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And our challenge right now is that the name of our organization is globally recognized and the association is quite positive. And so we really value that. And the last thing I want to do is kind of add confusion into who we are. And at this moment of fake news and everything, we'd want to be really thoughtful about how we change the name. The name is confusing because these issues have all evolved and we do tackle so much more. And so in many ways, it's confusing that way. So when we come up with that fantastically easy to follow name that says exactly what we're trying to say, we will definitely adopt it. So I hope your listeners send us some of their good ideas.
Yeah, Science Bulletin, it falls a little flat. So there's a word in there that makes sense.
Yeah.
We hope you guys enjoyed this. Rachel, thanks so much for your time. Anybody who is interested in following this conversation more closely, I highly recommend you check out the Bulletin's website, thebulletin.org. You can also follow Rachel on Twitter. She's at RachelBronson1. If you want to follow Andrew or myself, I'm at JulianWasHere. Andrew is at MarsRaider. We do these episodes every Monday. We hope to have you back next week. Rachel, thanks again for the time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.